Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Vinyl Guide Podcast. This week we are talking quadraphonic audio with Kamran V of Cykik.com. That's Cykik.com. And today he and I are going to discuss the history of quadraphonic sound, the various formats, the pluses, the minuses, and of course, the quadraphonic vinyl records. Kamran has just pressed what is widely believed to be the very first quadraphonic vinyl record in the last 30 years and features four-channel audio from Suzanne Ciani. It's an amazing project, an impressive package, and not only comes with the quadraphonic records, but also the decoder and all the cables in the box. You could learn more at Cykik.com. That's Cykik.com. Now today I have three quick plugs. Number one, we just uploaded an unboxing video of the brand new Blue Note Review box set, volume 2. It just came out and I put a video on our Vinyl Guide YouTube channel. Give us a Google, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and enjoy a sneak peek into an awesome record set from our friends at Blue Note Records. Plug number two, our friends at Groove Washer are still giving Vinyl Guide listeners 10% off everything using promo code VinylGuide10. I use the Groove Washer record cleaning kits every single day, so please give them some love at groovewasher.com. Use promo code VinylGuide10 and you'll get 10% off everything. And finally, plug number three, if you like the Vinyl Guide podcast, please consider becoming a patron of our show at patreon.com/vinylguide. There you can help sponsor us and access exclusive content, such as our patron-only episode number 151 featuring Sixtoe searching for Sugarman Rodriguez. Had him on the show, and that episode is only available to our patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. And of course, our high-definition video of our interview with AC/DC and Rose Tattoo bass player Mark Evans. Again, those are exclusive only to the patrons of the Vinyl Guide podcast. Plus, you get the warmness in your heart of helping keep this podcast going. Head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, sign up to be a show patron, and start enjoying the exclusive patron-only content today. And with the plugs done, let's jump into our conversation on the history and possible future of quadraphonic vinyl with Kamran V. This week on the Vinyl Guide, we are talking with Kamran V, who's an engineer in Los Angeles, has done many things throughout the music industry in his career. However, very interestingly, Kamran has recently developed the first quadraphonic record pressed, I believe, in the last 30 years. Is that right, Kamran?
That's what I'm told, yeah. First quad vinyl in over 30 years, yeah.
Did it surprise you that it was so long since the last quad record was pressed?
Yes and no. I mean, I guess it surprised me because there have always been spatial sound experiments going on in different forms. But yeah, I think the quad vinyl thing, I was really surprised, especially since the resurgence of vinyl had been going on so long by the time I did this.
Now, I want to talk to you about this record. I'm absolutely fascinated about the motivations and the process and everything you went through to be able to make it. I'm also going to give it a plug right now. Listeners can see or even order a copy at Cykik.com. That's C-Y-K-I-K. Just going chronologically, before we get into your record, I want to talk a little bit about the history of quadraphonic. You're a big fan of quadraphonic, I would imagine.
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of, you know, what used to be called just surround sound in the 80s and 90s. And quad became this thing that was an epiphany to me after going through a period of exploring surround sound and coming to meet Suzanne Ciani, who's been doing quadraphonic spatial sound since before that was even a thing in the late 60s.
I understand how the industry arrived at quad, or at least I think I do. Let me know if I'm incorrect in any of this. In the 50s and 60s, music was becoming a larger part of people's lives. There was more and more investment in things like stereo systems. Actually, we'd recently gone from mono to stereo, and you know, it's natural that people want to push it a little bit further and enrich that experience. What moment or product do you credit with to be the birth of quadraphonic?
Well, the birth of quadraphonic as a format was, I believe it was the late 60s. It was reel-to-reel tape, quad reel-to-reel tape. Mm-hmm. And that as a commercial product didn't last too long from what I understand. And it went right into pressed vinyl because that was the sort of mass-produced format of the time.
Okay, so reel-to-reel quadraphonic started first. Was it a similar sort of process that they ended up using on the vinyl records, or was that a different format?
It's different. The quadraphonic reel-to-reel was discrete tracks on reel-to-reel tape. And quadraphonic vinyl initially started as various matrixed formats, meaning that they used, you know, effectively an audio effect that took four channels and put it down to two. And it's, I guess you could call it a sort of a compression, but it wasn't really what we would think of compression. What it did is it hid in the early formats, it sort of hid the other tracks using 90 degree phasing for the rear channels and some steering logic and things like that. And there were different flavors of it, the most popular being SQ and QS, which I ended up using a version of QS, you know, also known as regular matrix, and worked with several folks, and really most closely worked with a company called Involve Audio out of Melbourne, Australia, who has a very, very intelligent, I don't know if the right way to say it is version of QS, but it is compatible with QS. It's just very separated. So it was been a good one.
So let me try to simplify this a little bit. Especially for me, I'm trying to picture this. When I think of a record groove, I think of a valley, okay? And you know, just put my fingers like a V. And on one side of the V is the left channel, and on the other side is the right channel. And when the stylus goes into that valley, it's able to discern, you know, left channel goes to the left channel, right channel goes to the right channel. Now, in a quad system, how does that work physically?
It actually works identical. The audio, the resulting audio is really just a stereo track. There was another format that was a little more complicated called CD4, which was it was called a discrete format, but it used a 30 to 40 kilohertz carrier signal to sort of encode the other channels. But the, you know, sort of most common quadraphonic is really just a stereo file. Those SQ and QS files, and even the files that I ended up with Suzanne Chiani, they're two-track files. You actually can listen to the very same audio on a record as you can on YouTube, Spotify, broadcast radio, literally any stereo format, and decode from that file out to four channels that are intentionally in those four channels. It's not too dissimilar to the early Dolby Pro Logic, which is Pro Logic 2's actually happens to be based on this very same technique.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And again, I'm just trying to piece this together in my head. You talked about a different format. So there are the matrix formats, which you just described and which you used, which are the four channels that are folded into the two and use a decoder to pull out and separate those four channels. Those are matrix systems. Those are, I believe, SQ and QS were the matrix systems. And then you just mentioned CD4, which is a discrete four-channel system, very similar to the reel-to-reel, where there are actually four channels.
Little different, different. The reel-to-reel was completely discrete, whereas CD4, which has nothing to do with compact discs, coincidentally, It had a special stylus, and it had a decoder, and it had this method, and it is known as a discrete format, but I guess these days it's tough to even argue how discrete it was. It just was able to provide a very broad, very deep separation between all the channels, which, you know, now with the more modern versions of these matrix systems, you can get up to like 30-something dB per channel separation, which is pretty indistinguishable.
It sounds like CD4 back in the day. I mean, and when I say back in the day, this is you know, mid to late 70s. CD4 was the best quadraphonic format. However, it required a lot of dedicated equipment to make it so. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. And even with all of that equipment, it was very temperamental. From what I'm told, it's even down to the impedance of the cabling would make a drastic difference on how successful the decoding was. So it would drop out a lot, which, you know, though technically on paper, it was the most technically superior format, it just didn't work as easily as the other formats. So even within the realm of the sort of failing format of quad at that time, it was the one that was the least reliable, but the highest technical quality.
Let's shrink down to the size of a molecule that will fit on the end of a record stylus. If we went into the SQ or the QS record groove, this is on the matrix systems, what would we do differently than a stereo signal?
Well, it's the way that the audio is encoded into that stereo signal. The actual stereo signal, there's zero difference as far as playback, pressing, everything about it. It's just an audio file. But what happens before it becomes that two-track audio file is the four channels are using, you know, a phasing effect or a 90-degree phase effect in the case of QS with some extra, you know, steering logic and math to keep the encode of that as solid as possible. And then what it does when you play it back, you're playing back a two-channel audio file or vinyl. And when you play it back, it sounds great. It sounds like a good mix. It even carries some psychoacoustics to make you feel like it's sort of surrounding you, even though it's coming out of two channels. But if you put this little magic box after your phono preamp, you'll get four dedicated channels with intentionally separate audio. And in the case of the Suzanne record and a lot of other records of that time that I've, you know, rediscovered and even recovered some, it's pretty impressive. I had very low expectations going into exploring the format and came to find out how viable and incredible it is, even as a format today.
If we had a quad record of something that was released in the mid-70s, I don't know, Frampton Comes Alive, something that was big in the day, and then we put that next to a two-track version, a normal stereo version, would an average listener be able to tell the difference between the two?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, there is... What's interesting is there are a lot of releases that are out there right now that people don't even know the difference. So I believe there's like a Santana record that is on every format you can think of that actually is quad. And most people have no idea because it's not marked as such. However, back then they actually did different mixes for quad and stereo. And if you were to listen to them back to back, the quadraphonic mix does have a bit more space in it. It does feel wider. And sometimes that's an intentional effect, and sometimes that's not an intentional effect. So what was interesting about the creative process of this is understanding sort of the intention of even what that stereo output needed to be, because we also put this out on all of the digital formats. And we also understood that people may just listen to the vinyl in stereo. And it was important that that sounded good. And, you know, to my surprise, it did sound great in all the experiments I did, and gave me a lot of confidence. And it's really just a matter of, if there's anyone that's, you know, ever mixed a record, you can do it a number of ways. And it really comes down to the intention of what you want to have happen. So the ability to monitor each phase of this quadraphonic encoded stereo and then decoded quadraphonic, just knowing what's going to happen is really the key to making it all work and sort of committing to it. But back in the day, there were definitely different mixes. There would be a stereo master and a quad master, even though the quad master could technically be played stereo and sound great.
Do you know if the record companies employed any sort of criteria to what got released on stereo and quad versus what just got released on stereo?
You know, I don't know. I don't know what, I mean, the only thing I can give you is my experience when I was at Interscope. I did Sting record and Nine Inch Nails and Beck records and stuff like that. And those mixes were different mixes, first of all, most specifically because of the way the format worked. It was DVD audio and SACD. But those were also, you know, sort of picked. They were commissioned, even though, you know, there was a big push at that time. And they were financed by Sony or Panasonic to make those. And I would imagine, and what I've been told is very similarly back then, that was something that was happening, where either the labels were vested in the format as a partner, and or there was some sort of, you know, business case to push towards that. So, you know, it started out with pretty high-end artists, and just like I was mentioning with Nine Inch Nails and Beck, they're, you know, big artists. And it rarely came down to, you know, sort of lesser-known artists, though it happened. And you'll find a lot of really good stuff when the format was sort of at its peak.
Mm-hmm. And the SQ and QS formats, those are both Matrix systems. They both came out in the mid-70s. They marketed themselves as quadraphonic. But were they compatible? They seem to have been embraced by different record companies.
Yeah, they were actually incompatible. I mean, you can play one through the other and get some sort of effect, but they were different in the way that they were implemented, which, you know, didn't make people happy. Like, if you look at older receivers, at the beginning, they were all very specifically one format or the other: SQ, QS, CD4, Electro Voice, I think, was one of them. There were several. There were a lot of them for a time. And then as you get into the mid-70s, those receivers end up having combination decoders, and you can choose the format. But you still need to know what format you're listening to choose. And, you know, when you get to the sort of peak of quadraphonic, many of them had an SQ, QS, and CD4 decoder in it. The quality of those decoders would vary depending on who the manufacturer was. Sometimes your SQ decoder wasn't as good as your QS decoder or whatnot in that particular box. So for instance, Sansui developed QS. So in their receiver, they would have the highest quality decoder in most cases. And the SQ decoder would function, but it may not have been as good as the highest end one at the time. So it was definitely confusing and expensive. At that time in the 70s, just having a hi-fi at all, let alone a quadraphonic hi-fi, was still a big deal. People would come over to everyone's house to like listen to Dark Side of the Moon in quad or stereo, for that matter. You know, it would be a thing.
Roll a doobie and sit in the middle of the floor. Yeah.
Exactly.
So if someone took an SQ record and played it with the switch on QS, is there a big difference? Would they immediately know something's wrong? Or okay.
Yeah, you're not getting the math is different enough where you're gonna know something's wrong. I mean, it'll have sort of, I don't know, if you remember the early Dolby ProLogic ones, they had effects where you could add a hall effect and things like that were unintentional and not, you know, you're not playing a surround sound VHS or whatever you're playing. But it definitely was one of those things where you could experiment, but it was not intentional. You wouldn't get what you wanted, and you'd know there was a difference. Right. Yeah.
And was there a consumer backlash because of so many formats that consumers were trying to push the manufacturers to have a single one, to agree on a single one, or was the concern not that sophisticated?
You know, it's tough for me to know, but it, I mean, in what I've read, because I'm 39 years old now, I was not of the time, but from what I've read and what I've talked to a lot of great experts that I worked with on this, you know, it was confusing, but it also was exciting, right? It was there are all these choices and all these benefits and risks of choosing which one. And then, of course, once the receivers could play any of them, for the consumer, it kind of didn't matter as much. But the reality was it was still very expensive. You know, in today's dollars, a quadraphonic system was about $5,000. That's quite a lot. And a lot of it was just such a niche thing. It's like, you know, like the way even today, like, you know, the Atmos is the sort of Atmos and DTS:X are sort of the new formats of the day, the most sophisticated spatial formats. You probably don't know very many people that have those systems. And the people that do, they paid a lot for them. And I think that is part of why the format suffered, was just the pure expense and access, both on the listening and even the creation side.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's one of the primary reasons why Quadraphonic wasn't successful?
Yeah, I really do. I think that it was really the cost and access were the primary issues. And of course, having multiple formats didn't really help. And, you know, technology, it was an idea that may have been a little ahead of its time. It wasn't easy to do these things. Today, the math that's involved to decode or encode quadraphonic is nothing as far as code. It is a very, very small file, very small amount of code. You know, it's kind of like computers today, right? You know, we have supercomputers in our pocket. Back then, you know, just having an extra phone line was a big deal. So, or a phone line. So it's similarly with the music technology.
So for your project, the Suzanne Ciani Quadraphonic Record, what led you to the conclusion that this is something you wanted to produce?
Well, we had invited her. I used to produce a festival called Moogfest, and we had invited her to do one of a series of events around the country that was, you know, celebrating the thinking behind that, which it was a music, art, and technology festival. And she had not performed. She was an early sort of synth pioneer working under Don Buchla. So in the early days of synthesizers, there was Don Buchla on the West Coast and Bob Moog on the East Coast. And working under Don in the late 60s, the Buchla synthesizer, the 200, had quadraphonic outputs on it from the beginning. And this is before the format was actually, you know, established as a commercial released format. So Suzanne had always worked in quadraphonic when she was using synthesizers. And when she came back to do this event in San Francisco, this is the first time she had done that in 40 years. It was a moment for her. And, you know, she had a very successful career in new age music, is what it's sometimes called, like a sort of early flavor of that when that was burgeoning as a genre. And a lot of other classical, she's an amazing classically trained pianist. But what this moment was for her was coming back to this instrument that she hadn't really used in 40 years. And what is fascinating as a musician, as an engineer, as just a technologist, she did this, and this recording is actually of that first time in 40 years, all live, also mixed all live. The spatialization of everything, she's doing 100% of that herself.
So Suzanne plays this show, this synthesizer, for the first time in 30, 40 years, and it is recorded and mixed. Everything is captured in quadraphonic, or at least in four channels at that time. Is that correct? What we hear on the record is what was captured at that moment.
Yeah, it is. And of course, like, you know, there are some little tweaks to master and some, you know, fixes where there was some distortion, a couple little things there. But mostly it is right what came out of her synthesizer. And the epiphany for me on this, you know, having explored spatial formats, was I think we recorded this in April. March. She performed at Moogfest. We had these durational performances, we called them, which were multi-hour, 3-4 hour performance, which were also, you know, in quadraphonic. We decided that would be, you know, sort of a thing that we would do, and other artists participated. And then it wasn't until we played back this performance at the North Carolina Museum of Art, I believe it was. And it was in a massive ovular field. And we put speakers on, you know, the four, we'll call it corners of the oval. And to really see people immerse themselves, engage in such a big area with these four discrete speakers. And then, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. I had a friend who had some friends pass away, and I went on a trip with him to Athens and had this Athens, Georgia, and had this really amazing creative trip. And it all just clicked as how musical Quad is, mm-hmm. and how forward thinking Suzanne is in the how she was performing then and how she came back to it as sort of a discipline. And it made me realize that, you know, I had experiences in 5.1 records where it was very difficult for the producers to understand how to create that space. And just in this case, the simple fact of not having a center channel or a sub to deal with as far as like thinking creatively, I realized that this is a format, this is a spatial format, the sort of lowest minimum format in spatial format that you can write music in, that you can actually think in. And there doesn't necessarily have to be a front or a back, even though it's labeled as such. It is a truly spatial, even format, which lends itself really nicely to where exploration of spatial sound is happening now in augmented and virtual reality environments. And Suzanne, sort of in her discipline, really has set an example for how anyone can explore spatial sound as both a performative and listening format. And it just all clicked at once. It was really interesting. So I didn't necessarily know that it was going to be vinyl. You know, I thought of all kinds of ways to create space, even, you know, the Flaming Lips format of like they did the thing, Zyreka, where they did four CDs and you had to play them all at the same time, or modifying a cassette deck, because cassettes technically are four tracks, you know, the old four track recorders. But vinyl and this matrixed format, I realized, provided the most interesting opportunity creatively, with the most, you know, sort of, I would say, the most innovative persons, early innovative person in this field of spatial audio, that we made this, and it can be on anything as, you know, sort of simple as pressed vinyl, or as complicated as a high resolution digital file, but be put through every existing format that is out there right now. And it's an amazing opportunity, I think, creatively.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm just being devil's advocate. That pressing a quadraphonic vinyl, it's a format that failed initially. It's not something that I think more people in the 70s would have had quadraphonic systems than have them now. So mm-hmm. I would imagine, you know, the little voice in your head is saying, well, why don't I just put this out on a 5.1 audio CD and be done with it? Mm-hmm. What made you persevere and pursue vinyl?
I love vinyl. I think that's part of it. I just think it's really cool as a format. I think the idea of squishing all of this space into vinyl is really interesting to me. You know, it's the story, it's the romance of it all. And we, you know, we only, you know, put out 227 of them. It wasn't, you know, we're not out to sell millions of records or hundreds of records, even for that matter. Only a couple hundred.
Now, that's another question here. I mean, you pressed up 227 units. Why such an abstract number?
So I had mentioned earlier that Suzanne's synthesizer was the Buchla 200, and the modern version of it is the 200E. And I really, really, really wanted to make it $200, and it just wasn't possible. I mean, what we're selling these for, we're selling them for $227, and there's 227 of them for sale. And, you know, this is a break-even project. You know, I spent about $50,000. We'll make about $50,000 once they're all sold out, which there aren't very many left anymore, which is awesome. but I couldn't make it for 200. So I went to Suzanne and I said, I'm really trying to make it 200. Is there something meaningful in the Buchla? Because they all have these numbers in them. Is there a meaningful module in the Buchla that would make sense? That's a little bit more than $200 that maybe I can try and make the math work, you know, depending on all the factors of manufacturing, right? And she said, well, the device that's actually doing the quadraphonic output and routing this and even doing some light effects on spatialization is the Buchla 227. So the thing that does the quad work is the Buchla 227. And that's how we arrived at that. And it's, you know, so I've been doing, 227 is cool. And, you know,
that works.
There was a show in the 80s that I really liked called 227. So why not?
So, and again, people can see this package at Cykik, CYKIK.com. They could order a copy. Doesn't sound like there's too many left, so you probably want to do it fairly quick. But it's not just a record. It's a record and a decoder, right? Can you describe the package, like what people will get for that 227?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of in the size of an old 2-inch tape box. It's a pretty thick box, and the thickness of it is defined by the power supply of the decoder and the decoder itself. And we intentionally left the decoder as a raw circuit board. It says Diva of the Diode on it, which is a name that a friend of mine, Mr. Bonsai, actually came up for her back, I think, in the 80s. And it has, we made an enamel pin that's in there. We have the vinyl, which is 180-gram vinyl that we mastered at Bernie Grundman Mastering and pressed at Third Man Pressing, which is Jack White's pressing plant. And, you know, this very, a friend of mine, Jeremiah Chu, designed the packaging. It's, you know, really high-end printing. You know, the box actually is the most expensive part of the whole package. It's this really beautiful box. And, you know, made this thing that we decided to even number it in four different places, which raises the level of complexity, not only in manufacturing, but also in shipping. We have the names. Suzanne signed a letter that has a number on it. The name of the person that bought it is written on it. The back of the vinyl sleeve has a number. The back of the box has a number. And then I hand etched a number in the right next to the matrix of every single piece of vinyl. So it was a lot of work. I don't know if I'll be doing it again.
Well, that was the next question. I mean, now you're starting to get some interest in quadraphonic out there, even if it's 227 people. You now have the decoder out there. You kind of have an infrastructure base to be able to work from. Do you think there will be a part two or a follow-up release?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually had a lot of interest and been doing a lot of work there. So the vinyl piece of it is a statement, right? It's a romantic statement of the past. However, the reality is that there's a lot of future opportunity for quadraphonic as a format, vinyl or any format. So even though we only did 227 of the vinyl, anyone can still listen to it on every digital platform out there. And they actually can decode it, not only from a vintage decoder and not only from our decoder or not only a new decoder that they would purchase from Envolve if they have one, but interestingly, the Dolby ProLogic 2 music mode with a dimension setting of -3 or -2 gets really, really close to decoding this faithfully. And it turns out that every receiver from 2001 to now has Dolby ProLogic 2 in it. And it's only the ProLogic 2. ProLogic 1 doesn't do it. It's ProLogic 2. So there is already this very big install base of people that can listen to the quad if they wanted to. And they could stream it right from Spotify and have a great experience. And where the opportunity is we have all of these now smart speakers out there that are effectively speakers with computers in them. And these computerized speakers can very easily have any of this math in it, including, you know, the Envolve Audio math, which is, you know, I would say the best format as far as the quadraphonic and, you know, sort of most compatible. So it's really, this is a, as a, well, you know, if there's, there's an agenda in this, it's, this is really an academic project, mm-hmm. is I believe that spatial music has had a lot of challenges, whether it was quad or DVD audio, SACD, even now with Atmos, Blu-ray, all of these types of things. It's been really challenging as sort of a format. And looking back to a format like Quadraphonic, where the barriers to creating a spatial music song are very, very low. You can have people have audio interfaces that are multi-channel and very easy to use. The software is very easy to use. There's free spatial panners, all that kind of stuff. People a lot of times have some extra speakers hanging out in their studio. Mm-hmm. And you can write music in quad. And with the opportunity of all of these receivers out there and the fact that any distribution channel can actually use this, distribute Quadraphonic work in this format, it's really a small step to having quad decoding in these smart speakers. Imagine your Amazon Echo or your Sonos system or whatever it is. You just, you know, buy four of them and they can do it. It's pretty interesting.
So according to Kamran V., we think Quadraphonic is actually going to be a viable option for musicians in the future.
Yeah, I think it is the most viable option because of how accessible and inexpensive it is, both to create and to listen. And it will only make things like Atmos and the creation of things in Atmos better, or even VR sound or any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me pitch you something. How about
okay?
How about octophonic? You know, going beyond the four, doubling them up, kind of making the diamond shape sound option. Is that something that has even been attempted before? Did they try to go beyond quad yet? Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, Atmos and DTS:X. Those are, you know, you can have 100 something channels in those systems very easily. Well, I shouldn't say easily. It's possible to do it. Yeah. But octophonic, you know, there's a lot of fine artists, sound artists, multimedia artists that work in octophonic. They call it, there's all kinds of terms that they call that, and even sort of non-traditional formats. You know, the idea of even having organized speakers is kind of going out of the window. You know, whether it's Atmos, the way it calibrates itself, it's what they call object-oriented. So no matter where you're putting the speakers in space, the system knows how it's supposed to distribute the audio. To experiments, installations where you're, you know, basically putting speakers in weird places that make no sense to many people. Like there's one in the bathroom, or there's one coming out of a guitar amp, or, you know, whatnot. You know, Brian Eno's done experiments with that. It's definitely, it can be anything. The thing with quad is it is this sort of lowest common denominator, four corners of a room kind of thing. And once you develop, once you make something in that space, with the way things work now with music creation and distribution, you can easily go back to your sort of quadraphonic mix and re-render that to any number of speakers. It's like adding more pixels to a screen. It's, you know, it's pretty fun, and technology is allowing that today.
Now, how is that modifying the way that artists record? Like back in the day, would an artist do anything special for quad, or did that always come afterward? They focused on the stereo, and then it was the mastering engineer who then made the quad version of it.
It varied, like today. You know, artists like Pink Floyd, you know, very much embraced it, and they were thinking of that as they were making music. Whereas there are a lot of things that you don't think of. There's a label. I worked with some friends at a nonprofit radio station called Dublab, where we did an exhibit at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and we worked with Impulse Records, which was a jazz label. Mm-hmm. They had, you know, Sun Ra Orchestra, Alice Coltrane, John Coltrane, a lot of folks, and they would go back and forth, from what I've told, between intentionally doing quad recording and working with the artists on that, to just taking the multi-track recording and turning it into quad and doing these very adventurous mixes. And we recovered some of those tapes for this LACMA exhibit that we did. And, you know, I think it's It's almost like back then, it was very expensive and difficult for an artist to record their own music. There weren't a lot of Les Pauls out there, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas now it is very common for people to make music on the computers, mix it, have a very firm understanding of how to mix and whatnot.
And have a jillion tracks to be able to put things on rather than, culling things down into singular stereo channels. Yeah,
exactly. So and that's why there's this opportunity, is that it is so much easier and so much less expensive. I mean, just the idea of recording anything in the 70s was a feat, and it took a lot of expensive equipment and well-trained people just to make that process work. Whereas today, you know, there's, you know, an iPhone app called Figure that I give to my four-year-old niece, and she can make an incredible beat that, you know, is danceable and good, right? Like anyone can make it. And she's, you know, not that she's not creative, because she is, but it is that easy that someone that has relatively low training,
the tools are much simpler and much more ubiquitous. Yeah. So you're just picking up on something you mentioned earlier. You're telling me that out there somewhere in a vault are some master tapes of quadraphonic sessions of the likes of John Coltrane and artists from the 60s that were perhaps folded down into stereo, but could potentially be released in full quadraphonic the way they were intended.
Yeah, yeah. Ed Michel, the guy who runs Impulse, he has a bunch of them. And it's interesting. He has some of them that they're these interesting compilations. But yeah, and I would bet there's a lot more, frankly, and many of them aren't even labeled, like on all kinds of labels. Like I said, that Santana record, it's not labeled as quadraphonic, but it is. You just need to know. And I think with the way artificial intelligence is working, you know, all of those interesting things like Google's Magenta or IBM's Watson or folks, things like that, the ability to detect what was intended to be quadraphonic is potentially easier, you know, training those AI brains to know what to listen for.
My goodness. All right. Well, there's another level of growth. I'd love to hear some of those old jazz recordings, because I'm a big fan of the Impulse label and Blue Note, and being able to have those sort of recordings in that format really excites me on that possibility. Let me ask you, is there any special gear needed for mastering quad records? Obviously there's the mixing that needs to be created, but does it eventually just make its way to a quarter inch tape and then goes for regular lacquering and plating, mm-hmm. that sort of thing? Is there any special items or any special activities that come in that chain?
Well, it's most ideal to do the quadraphonic encoding at mastering. I mean, obviously it's good to know, you know, like any mix, to know what you have some basic mastering when you're doing a mix, and know what that's going to be. And you want to, you know, sort of A, B, and C, in this case, the different ways. And in the same way you master audio for vinyl, mastering it for quadraphonic vinyl or quadraphonic any format is important. In our case, we, you know, it was not reel-to-reel tape, it was a digital file, but we were doing the encoding and monitoring the decoding in real time as Scott Cedillo at Bernie Grundman was mastering this. Mm-hmm. And once that was done and put to a final stereo master file, 24-bit 96K file, that was cut to a lacquer the same way any other vinyl is. We took a lot of precautions in testing. You know, we actually, this is a 45, so it's spinning a little faster, so the resolution is, you know, a little better. Yeah, a little higher resolution. Right after the vinyl was cut to lacquer, I hand delivered it down to Nipro Optics, which did the plating. You know, the faster you do that, the better the metal master is, because the lacquer, you know, expires over time. And then once we did that, we did test pressings at Third Man, and, you know, kept it a very tight system.
Far out. Also, do you know of any rare quad albums, even from back in the day? Are there any ones that are very elusive? Any quad albums that came out sounding fantastic, ones people should avoid? What's your recommendation on people who are digging through the secondhand racks and they see quad? What's some guidance on that?
Well, I'd say the CD4 ones are really tough to make work. It's a rare moment to be able to make those work, and it has less to do with the vinyl and more to do with the systems. I mean, you know, I can't pretend to be an expert on that side of it. There's a gentleman named Quad Bob who I became friends with in this, and he is the world's second largest collector of quadraphonic anything, and he of course knows the first. The number one collector, but he really knows all that stuff better than I. But you know, Dark Side of the Moon is an amazing quadraphonic experiment for a lot of reasons. But you know, I can't remember what the Quincy Jones record is, but I got an amazing quadraphonic Quincy Jones record that you know was done in quad and intentionally made in quad. There's a Switched on Bach that's in quad that sounds amazing. You know, Wendy Carlos actually had done a lot of spatial sound experiments. If you go to her website, there's an extensive essay on spatial sound, which it's tough to even know if she even likes it or not. I think she does, but it's a lot of good criticisms and a lot of good experiments. So, yeah, there's a lot of quadraphonic work out there. There's a couple websites. Quadraphonic Quad, I think, is a forum that has an extensive list of that.
Comrade, thank you so much for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide and explaining quadraphonic. It's always been a bit of a mystery to me. It's kind of eluded me. I always see those, you know, the logos on records, and I'm not sure whether I should buy them, whether I shouldn't, whether the sound is superior or not, or what that actually means. And so you've been able to break it down very nicely. We really appreciate it. And also I want to call people's attention to the Suzanne Ciani quadraphonic LP. Doesn't sound like there's too many left. I'm sure it's going to be something that people are going to kick themselves years from now for not getting when they could. It's available at psychic.com. That's CYKIK.com. I'll have links in the show notes on that as well. And Cameron, thank you so much for breaking it all down and explaining it. And I look forward to hearing more quadraphonic adventures from you in the future.
Great. Thanks so much, Nate.
Wow. That was really interesting. That was a fun conversation. Thanks for coming on the show, Kamran. I learned a lot. For many years, I've been flipping through record bins, and whenever I see the quadraphonic logo on one of the records, I wasn't quite sure whether I would get a good playing experience on my stereo or exactly what the result would be. So now I have the knowledge and the confidence to go ahead and pick those up. Again, I want to encourage folks to go over to psychic.com, CYKIK. There are only 227 of these units. Techmoan did a brilliant video. Wired did an article on this record. So get your hands on one while they're still available. It comes with a decoder. So especially you guys who are a bit nerdy and like wiring stuff up and trying new experiments, you will dig this Suzanne Ciani record over at psychic.com. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Not sure if I'll be back next week. It's a holiday in Australia. It's Australia Day. A lot of us will be at the beach or barbecuing or drinking beer or all of those three. So I'll do my best, but if you don't hear from me next week, likely be the following week. I'll be around, and plus there's 150-some episodes online you can enjoy if you really get lonely. Also, make sure to check out our video up on the Vinyl Guide YouTube channel, the unboxing of the Blue Note Review Volume 2, Spirit and Time. It is a fantastic box set, and you'll get a first fresh sneak peek up on the Vinyl Guide's YouTube channel right now. Until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.